Well, today has been a day, huh? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Thursday today, the 8th of September. Good as always to have you along, everybody. The British pound, on this day that the UK changed arguably forever, held steady. The pound did $1.15 American, buys you a pound sterling. And we will get to the UK in a minute. But we begin today with the greenback, the American dollar, which is on, you might say, a tear. Stronger, and in some cases, a lot stronger, against basically all the major currencies. Thank you very much, Jay Powell, and those interest rate increases, which make the dollar more attractive to foreign investors. And look, there are goods and bads out of that. American travelers, you're doing fine. You can get more scones on that trip to London. But if you're a country or a company that's got to buy staples in dollars or has to pay off dollar-denominated debt, you're kind of in a jam. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer gets us going.
The U.S. dollar is on a roll, soaring to a 20-year high against other currencies.
Yeah, at least a 20-year.
Brad McMillan is chief investment officer for Commonwealth Financial Network. He says the higher dollar is a burden for countries that import a lot.
If you're in a country that is paying for supplies like oil or fertilizer, those are priced in dollars. So the price you have to pay in local currency goes up significantly if the dollar is worth more.
Essential commodities like grain, iron, and copper are also dollar-denominated. Even that staple of British life, tea, is priced in dollars. Many countries also borrow in the U.S. currency. Jeffrey Frankel, an economist and professor at Harvard, says if the value of the dollar rockets way up against a currency like the peso, debt payments cost a lot more.
When the dollar is strong, when the peso depreciates against the dollar, if it's a 50% depreciation, suddenly it's become twice as expensive in terms of pesos.
Zoe Leo at the Council on Foreign Relations says some countries like Pakistan are already in trouble. Leo describes Pakistan's dollar-denominated debt as a ticking bomb. It could be defused if the payments were restructured.
But debt restructuring does not necessarily mean the country's debt level reduced, right? It's just a delay or a restructuring in payment.
If a country just can't pay, it defaults. That's already happening. Lebanon and Zambia each defaulted on U.S. dollar loans a couple years ago. I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, where, of course, the dollar is king, it was one of those what-me-worry days. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. You have, of course, heard by now of the death of Queen Elizabeth II today, and while there has been no shortage of coverage, as is right, we wanted to take just a minute here to talk about this moment in the British economy and what the Queen's passing represents over there. And for that, we've gotten Marketplace's Stephen Beard on the phone. Hello, Stephen.
Hello, Kai.
As I said in the introduction here, Stephen, this comes at a turbulent time for the United Kingdom. Inflation, new prime minister, great uncertainty, which the Queen was the very antithesis of, right? She was stability and consistency and all of those things.
Very much so. A symbol of stability, a very decent, steady, dutiful, and unpretentious person who had absolutely no enemies in the UK. And this death was not entirely unexpected. She'd been in poor health for some months, but it's a very sobering and a sad moment. She's been a part of everyone's life here for so long, just 70 years on the throne, Britain's longest reigning monarch. So not a totally unexpected event, but nevertheless quite a deep psychological blow to Britain at the moment.
Well, so on that last point about the psychology of the British public, I was listening to a BBC podcast the other day, and not to make an awkward turn to the marketplace part of this, but with inflation, with gas prices, with colder winter coming on, the word that kept coming up on this BBC podcast was fear. There is fear now about the economy and what people are going to do. This will be a moment now of a change in national mood as they mourn the Queen and try to get through it.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, she died, although at the age of 96, too soon. There is, as you say, a mood of tremendous anxiety and fear with inflation spiraling out of control. One forecast suggests it might be as high as 22% in the UK in January. A new government taking over. It's time of tremendous uncertainty and instability, a time when, boy, we certainly could do with Queen Elizabeth II's calming influence.
Stephen Beard, who covers all things European and, in this case, British for us. Stephen, thank you.
Thank you, Kai.
On the other side of the English Channel, the European Central Bank dropped the figurative interest rate hammer today, raising its benchmark rate 0.75 percentage point, the biggest bump the ECB has ever done. And Bank President Christine Lagarde made it completely clear they are not going to stop there. The thing that's interesting about the European Central Bank is that for most of the past 8 years, it has been dabbling with negative interest rates. Marketplace's Lily Jamali explains what's going on there.
The simple answer is inflation. It's bad here in the US, but it's even worse in Europe.
The inflation rate is just unprecedented here.
Maria Demeritis, deputy director of the Brussels-based economics think tank Bruegel, says energy prices especially are sky high because of Russia's ongoing war in Ukraine. So European policymakers are under pressure to make decisions as circumstances change by the day.
We have no idea how long this war will last, and therefore it's impossible to know how long the energy burden that we're feeling is going to last.
Record inflation in Europe has many countries moving to provide financial help to households, says Megan Green, global chief economist at the Kroll Institute.
We've heard about a number of fiscal stimulus measures coming out of Eurozone governments to try to subsidize energy costs and offset the cost of living crisis.
And that help could translate into Europeans buying more goods, which Green says could push inflation even higher. On top of that, Europe might start rationing energy because of the war.
Which would cause companies to shut down, which would be devastating for growth.
And growth is top of mind as Europe faces down the possibility of a recession, if it's not in one already. Klaus Vistesen, chief Eurozone economist at Pantheon Macroeconomics, says the outlook isn't great.
The ECB today believes the economy is going to stagnate. We think the economy is going to shrink, and so does everybody else.
And because the European Central Bank kept interest rates so low for as long as it did, right now, it has a lot of ground to make up. I'm Lily Jamali for Marketplace.
Coming up.
He said 3 to 5 pounds of rat feces sitting on top of the engine.
Oh, ew. Oh, man. First, though, let's do the numbers. Yeah, that's an awkward turn, right? Rat poop to being in the money? I don't even know. Dow Industrials up 193 today, 0.6%. Closed at 31,774. Did the blue chips. The Nasdaq up 70 points again, 0.6%, 11,862. S&P 500 up 26 points, 0.2%, 4,006. I can't quite get that image out of my mind. Moderna shot up 4.7% today after an upgrade from Deutsche Bank, which cited the company's strong second quarter results. Fellow COVID maker Pfizer, COVID vaccine maker, rather. That's an important distinction. Up 2% today. BioNTech added 0.2%. Clothing retailer American Eagle tumbled 8.7% today after second quarter earnings missed analyst expectations. This company did say also it expects to have more markdowns and promotions because of the current retail environment. Discount airline Frontier fell 4% after a downgrade from the research firm Raymond James. JetBlue down about 0.25%. Bond prices down. Yield on the 10-year T-note 3.32%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Hey everyone, it's Rima Jerez, host of This Is Uncomfortable. If you're looking for some good recommendations on books to read, well, you should join This Is Uncomfortable's Summer Book Club. Every other week in our newsletter, we'll share a new book that'll make you rethink your relationship to money, class, and work, while also featuring an interview with the author or an expert on the topic. Plus, when you join, you'll be entered in a giveaway where you could win some This Is Uncomfortable merch. Be sure to check it out. Sign up today at marketplace.org/bookclub.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdal. Jay Powell gave a set of remarks at a think tank conference this morning in which the Fed chair said, as he has said before, that the Fed is going to keep raising interest rates until inflation is well and truly tamed. That's basically the same message Powell delivered at the Jackson Hole conference a couple of weeks ago when he said, and I'm paraphrasing here, but only by a little bit, Powell said there is going to be pain. Pain, though, for whom and as compared to what? We've gotten Michelle Holder back on the phone to help figure that out. She's Associate Professor of Economics at the City University of New York. Michelle, it's good to talk to you again.
Nice to talk to you as well, Kai.
You watched Powell's speech, whatever it was, a week, 10 days ago, and he makes it really clear there's going to be some pain. As the trained economist in the room, what did you think he was meaning?
Well, I think Chair Powell was, you know, essentially just trying to continue to prime the American public about the very likelihood that the unemployment rate will probably continue to rise, including the Black unemployment rate, the Latinx unemployment rate, as well as the white unemployment rate, etc. So I think he's just reiterating and trying to get us ready for this.
Well, we're going to break down who feels the pain and how they feel it in a second, but I want to be clear here. He is plainly saying that he and the Federal Reserve believe that the pain of inflation is worth the pain of higher unemployment.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't agree with that sentiment. I think
my characterization's right. That's what he's saying.
Yeah, that is what he's saying. Yeah.
All right. Now go on and explain to me why you disagree.
Yeah, I disagree because, you know, it's pretty straightforward and simplistic, but the Fed does have a dual mandate, not just, you know, maintaining price stability, but also maximizing employment. Mm-hmm. And so in this speech, it was very clear that he was prioritizing inflation over unemployment. And I think if you asked the average person in America, would they prefer to either have a job if they are working, right, if they are engaged in the labor market, mm-hmm. or pay higher prices for goods? I think they would typically say, I'd rather have a job.
Okay, so to your earlier point, Powell says this at some point in this very brief speech he made the other day. Yeah. The burdens of high inflation fall heaviest on those who are least able to bear them. Your point in your disagreement with the chair is that unemployment is going to come fastest to Black workers, to Latino workers, to those at the bottom end of the income spectrum.
Absolutely. I mean, so as an example, if, you know, Chair Powell had explicitly said that you should anticipate the overall unemployment rate in this country to go up by 1 or 2 percentage points, what that translates into for Black workers and for Latinx workers is a 2 to 4% increase in their unemployment rates. The issue is that Black unemployment and Latinx unemployment, i.e. unemployment rates for people of color in this country, are multiples of the average unemployment rate. And it's also they are also multiples of the white unemployment rate. So the burden is just not equally shared in terms of when you're talking about increased joblessness.
All right. So look, let me poke you in the eye for a minute and ask you this. So should Powell and the Fed just stop raising rates and worrying about inflation? What's the option here that they have?
Right. Happy you asked that question, because as an economist, I understand and I agree that the Fed has to act, and the Fed has acted. In fact, it's raised interest rates 3 times already this year. So it is, you know, it is engaging in, what we would want our central bank, our Federal Reserve Bank to do, which is to try to tame inflation. But I think the key is, how fast are these rate increases going to continue, and how high will they continue to go? The Fed has been pretty aggressive for the first half of this year into July. My hope is that it begins to moderate, how far it's going to push the pedal to the metal in terms of trying to tame inflation, because it does have this balancing act that it has to strike.
Michelle Holder is an associate professor of economics at the City University of New York, also a senior fellow at the Washington Center for Equitable Growth. Michelle, thanks a lot. It's great to have your insights and your perspective.
Oh, it's a pleasure to talk to you again, Kai. Thanks so much.
A couple of days ago, Samantha Fields reported for us on the collateral damage that spiking natural gas prices in Europe might wind up doing to the broader economy. Since then, though, and I'm only talking 48 hours, prices have swung way the other way. European benchmark nat gas has come down by about a third. Although, to be clear, it is still really expensive compared to what it cost before the Russian invasion of Ukraine. But every little decline helps, right? Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman has that one.
There are some signs Europe may be getting a handle on its Russia-induced energy crisis. For one, the recent sharp decline in natural gas prices, says Capital Economics' Edward Gardner.
The European Union's gas storage levels are at around 85% of capacity. So it could well be that markets are pricing in that Europe might be better prepared than it once was.
European countries have been increasing non-Russian supplies of natural gas from Norway and the Netherlands, and lining up more shipments of liquefied natural gas from Africa and Canada. Germany and Italy, traditionally the heaviest users, have cut their reliance on Russian energy. Weather may also help by tamping down demand this winter, which is expected to be mild by recent historic standards. But risks abound for Europe.
The overall situation is bad.
Patrick Honohan is former governor of the Central Bank of Ireland and now a fellow at the Peterson Institute for International Economics. He says European officials are planning measures to encourage conservation and help consumers deal with high energy costs. But he says big questions remain.
To what extent industrial producers, households in various countries can substitute away from natural gas that used to flow from Russia and can cope with the rising and the high costs of not just natural gas, but oil and other energy products.
He says the overarching unknown is Russia's war in Ukraine.
We don't know how long this war is going to go on and to what extent an end to the war will lead to a reversal in these spikes of energy prices.
He says one thing's clear, Russia's earning so much selling its oil on global markets, it doesn't really need to resume selling its natural gas to Europe anytime soon. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
So we are going to take a little turn here. The show's been kind of serious today, kind of heavy, right? So let's change the mood a bit and talk about rats. Didn't say it'd be a better mood, did I? Rats are scary and they're gross. And they are a huge economic problem. They do a whole lot of damage to crops, to food supplies overall, to communications networks, your cars even. So off we go now to New York City, home to Marketplace's Sabri Benishour, and something like 2 million rats.
We are a few avenues west of Times Square. It's mostly warehouses and garages around here. This is where Joel Paternoster's car is parked. He started having car troubles back in 2020.
As I started driving, the car started billowing smoke, but it wasn't overheating. I drove into a local garage. The guy pops the hood and he's like, "You have rats. They made a nest." And there was about, he said, 3 to 5 pounds of rat feces sitting on top of the engine. And it was literally frying.
He says he has seen more rats in his neighborhood since the pandemic started.
I had to get about $2,500 worth of wires replaced because the rats chewed through them.
There isn't a rat census, but rat sightings in the first quarter of 2022 were up 60% from the same time in 2019, according to the city. It is up in the air whether there are actually more rats or whether people are just seeing them more.
We are living in an infestation right now. This is in tandem with the outdoor dining.
Shannon Phipps is among the New Yorkers who blame the alleged increase in rats on outdoor dining. Earlier during the pandemic, when indoor dining was not allowed, thousands of restaurants created outdoor covered dining areas on the street to stay in business. Phipps points to chewed holes in the side of an outdoor dining structure in her Williamsburg neighborhood.
This is really good for them to come in and out, and it becomes another habitat for them and another food source.
Some dining structures are in pristine condition, with solid floors and carpeting. Others have slats for flooring, with gaps where food scraps can collect. Many have rat bait stations. Michael Sussman is a lawyer who's filed 2 lawsuits against the city over the outdoor dining program.
We think there has to be a pervasive dismantling of the emergency sheds.
Up on the Upper West Side, restaurant owner Manny Colon is showing off his outdoor section at Manny's Cafe. It is built on the street and is immaculate, painted a crisp maroon and shiny black with carpeted floors.
With a weatherproof roof, which is a 3-layer roof, and also the greenery that's planted all around. So I follow all the guidelines that went above and beyond.
He says the outdoor dining let him hire 2 additional servers and 2 more staff in the kitchen.
There are some structures that were not built sound. Maybe some people just couldn't afford to build them, you know, following the guidelines, or some people just didn't care. And the ones that are not taken care of and that are hazardous, and get rid of them.
He points down the street to another battleground in the rat wars, a pile of trash bags sitting on the sidewalk.
This is, you know, city garbage coming from residential buildings, not from a restaurant.
Trash bags in New York are left out on the street in massive piles on trash day. New York cut its sanitation department's budget early in the pandemic, resulting in fewer workers and less frequent trash pickup and more food for rats. Sandy Nurse is a council member in Brooklyn.
Currently, New York City is spending $4.9 million on rat mitigation. And last year, New York City spent about $281,000.
The subway system spends another million on rat control, and the overall sanitation budget is now bigger.
So we should be on track to be able to provide a baseline of rat mitigation services that we weren't doing in the last 2 years.
For now, though, rats are as visible as they ever have been.
Well, I am walking down the street in Hell's Kitchen, and I just saw just ran right almost on my foot. Okay, that was about 5 rats that just crossed the sidewalk there. Oh, here's another one lounging.
This is a situation that Joel Grassi has to deal with all the time. He is with BHB Pest Elimination. His advice for dealing with the rats in the city: learn to live with them.
When you're talking about rats in New York City and human beings, you're talking about cohabitation, coexistence.
Rats have been in this city for 300 years, since they stowed away here on British ships. They've been making news since at least the 1850s. They are not going away. But we will spend many millions trying to make them. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishour for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, in which there is not a hint of a marketplace angle, but regular listeners to this program will know that I firmly believe history matters, so here you go. Queen Elizabeth had 15 prime ministers. Liz Truss is the incumbent and the last. Winston Churchill was her first. Churchill was born in 1874, 101 years before Liz Truss, which I just think is kind of wild. All right, we're going. Here is your moment of economic context related to nothing at all in the program today, but I just thought it was worth a mention. The NFL season starts tonight, but ad rates for the Super Bowl are already set. Saw this on Bloomberg that Fox is selling 30 seconds of ad time during a football game for $7 million. Inflation, am I right? Amir Bibawi, John Buckley, Eve Epstein, John Gordon, Rick Carr, Diantha Parker, Amanda Peacher, and Stephanie Seek are the Marketplace editing staff. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
Hey, everyone. It's Rima Khreis, host of This is Uncomfortable. If you're looking for some good recommendations on books to read, well, you should join This is Uncomfortable's Summer Book Club. Every other week in our newsletter, we'll share a new book that'll make you rethink your relationship to money, class, and work, while also featuring an interview with the author or an expert on the topic. Plus, when you join, you'll be entered in a giveaway where you could win some This Is Uncomfortable merch. Be sure to check it out. Sign up today at marketplace.org/bookclub.